Welcome to Software Gone Wild. Today with a weird topic, software-defined DNS. And if you're going like, wait, what? At this moment, you're totally right. We'll talk about DNS. Chris Beavers and Alex Weil from NS1 contacted me not so long ago, and they are working on an interesting DNS platform. And as I just started working on my interop presentation, which will talk about active-active data centers, and DNS is a big part of that, it was just a perfect fit, and I told them that, yeah, we should do a podcast on this topic. So today, I have Chris Beavers, CEO of NS1, with me, and he'll tell you all you need to know about DNS and what they call data-driven DNS. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Ivan. Thanks for having us.
So, shall we start with you or with the company?
Whatever you like. You know, why don't I give you just a little bit of background on myself and where we're coming from as a company, and then we can kind of dive in on the tech.
Sounds like a good plan. Let's go.
Okay. So, I myself and much of our company have been in the internet infrastructure space for a very long time. Our last company was called Voxel. It was a managed hosting and sort of an everything infrastructure company based in New York for most of the 2000s, and was acquired around the end of 2011 by Internap. And at that time, we started to think about, well, what's next for us? One of the problems we had solved at Voxel in the context of building a content delivery network was, how do we get the eyeballs to the right data center? So any kind of CDN or distributed application, we have this problem of endpoint selection. So given that we can provide service to an end user from any number of data centers around the planet, how do we pick the right one and in response to what kinds of conditions, whether they're real-time or maybe statically configured conditions, should we route somebody to a particular data center? And in the CDN we had at Voxel, we did this with a DNS network that we built ourselves from the ground up and experimented and tinkered with for probably 5, 6, 7 years to figure out what works and what doesn't. And we had always wanted to go productize this at Voxel, and we just didn't have time. We were doing too many other things. And so this became a good reason for us to look around at the DNS space and at how people were building applications. And think about, is there an opportunity for us to do something here? And that's where NS1 comes from.
So what is it that you do? Do you have a product, or do you have a platform, or is it just software, or is it all of the above?
It's a great question. It's actually somewhat all of the above. And this is a departure from what you typically see in the DNS space. So, you know, I often segment the space in a couple of ways. One is, you know, what we'd call managed DNS. And this is SaaS model kind of DNS delivery. This is what most people think of when they think of a DNS company or a DNS offering. There's another piece of the puzzle, which is software, sometimes hardware appliances, which do DNS. And you'll often see this referred to as the DNS, DHCP, and IP address management space. So we actually play in both spaces to a certain degree because of how we've built our stack. So we went and we built a modern kind of software framework and platform for delivering DNS. And it turns out that thanks to, you know, recent changes in how applications are built and deployed, especially automation and configuration management tools, we don't really care how we or where we deploy our tools and our software. So in addition to operating a big global anycasted managed DNS network that we sell and offer in a SaaS model, and we also sell private DNS networks, which are topologically tailored to the requirements of our customers' applications, and those look a lot more like, you know, what you'd think of as a traditional appliance. So we kind of run the gamut.
So in the managed DNS space, my zone files are hosted at your servers.
You can think of it that way, except, you know, at this point.
I know it's
point,
not the zone file.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And so you know that. And in this day and age, you know, I think very few managed DNS providers are really delivering up straight up zone files. And the reason Right, is that DNS is starting to get smarter, and this is what we're all about. And in order to do that, no longer are we taking in, call it static DNS config, you know, zone files and static DNS that you think of when you're traditionally configuring DNS. Now we're starting to take in all sorts of other information that is useful to adding a little bit of intelligence in the DNS and making decisions dynamically when we get a DNS lookup, right? So if, you know, your end user is looking up whatever.com, and the moment you have more than one answer that you might give back to them, we have to move beyond the basic zone file representation and start to think a little bit more intelligently. And that's what our platform is all about.
Just to step back a little bit, your typical customer would be someone that has multiple data centers and wants to direct the end users to different data centers based on whatever metrics, right?
More or less. So, you know, I'll qualify that by saying that we have many, many customers who are not solving multi-data center problems, who are just looking for a modern take on DNS with, you know, good reporting or APIs or you know, a reasonable portal, those kinds of things. But, you know, where our platform absolutely stands apart is for those customers who are trying to solve this endpoint selection problem. And, you know, there's a history to this problem. And if you think about how applications have changed over the years and how they're deployed, it's a little bit instructive. So, you know, 10, 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, at this point, you were doing a really good job with DNS if you were running bind on more than one server, you know, maybe a primary and a secondary slave to it with fairly static config. And the reason is that DNS wasn't a weak link and people weren't really building applications that were heavily distributed across a bunch of different data centers. And that started to change in the early 2000s. And, you know Anycasting well. The idea of Anycasting at first meant the DNS could be a lot more reliable than it had been in the past. And, you know, we could fail over very quickly if a data center went offline. And over the course of the 2000s, that started to change and be a little bit more performance focused. You know, how quickly can we spit out a DNS answer when we're asked wherever in the world the user is who's asking. And what also started to change in the late 2000s is how applications are deployed. You know, 7, 8 years ago, if you were thinking about deploying your application in a second data center, that was a really big deal. It was a you know, real estate transaction and a lot of capex for servers and routers and switches and cross connect contracts and power and all of those things. And now you go to Amazon or DigitalOcean, you click a button and you have a new VM and probably a new market in 30 seconds, right? So the way applications are deployed has changed. The barriers to deploying in multiple data centers or multiple geographies has changed a lot. What hasn't changed too much is how people think about getting traffic to those data centers. You know, you have a few options. One is Anycasting, which is fun, but is incredibly complex and expensive to pull off. Another is in the DNS, you know, a couple of basic ideas that have existed for quite some time. So one is what we usually refer to as failover. And this is the idea that, you know, probably we shouldn't send users to servers that are down right now. So let's ping them. And, you know, if a server goes down, stop sending new traffic there. The other slightly more interesting idea is geographic routing. So this is where we start to get into performance optimization in endpoint selection in DNS. And the basic idea, of course, is let's try and figure out where a user is coming from, maybe based on a GeoIP database or something like that. And then let's send them to the data center that is closest to them physically. And the assumption, of course, is that that has something to do with performance. And in some cases it does, but the internet doesn't quite work that way. It's not embedded nicely geographically. So where we're moving the bar a little bit is on adding intelligent ways for you to direct traffic to your different data center endpoints. And we think of this in a few ways. So first and most important is that we can take in some interesting data about what's going on in your application or on the internet. And, you know, I usually bucket this in three ways. First, we want to know about your infrastructure. Where is it located, of course, and how's it connected to the internet, or what kind of capacity do you have online? How fat are your pipes? Those kinds of things. And that's kind of boring, you know, configuration information. But the more we know, the better we can, or the more granularly we can make traffic management decisions. The second bucket for us, which is where things start to get interesting, is we really want to know what's going on in your infrastructure right now. So are your servers in Ashburn overloaded, or are you saturating your pipe in Amsterdam? Those kinds of information help us avoid overload and direct traffic to data centers that are going to be able to service it effectively.
So how do you get that information?
Yeah, so great question. So one of the most important things we realized after doing this for years sort of internally in our CDN was that if we were going to go productize something like this and make it available to everybody, there was no way in the world that everybody with distributed infrastructure around the planet was going to buy into yet another agent, right? So they weren't going to drop some piece of software that we provided on their boxes to go gather all this data and send it to us. So instead, we took what I'd call an integration and API driven approach. So we integrate with a whole bunch of third-party monitoring and network data collection providers, many of whom our customers are already using and have already integrated into their operational frameworks. And the idea is that our customers shouldn't have to reinvent that wheel and find new ways or leverage new ways of gathering data that they already are gathering. We should instead just be able to take in that data. There's another way, which is that we provide very simple and straightforward APIs for our customers to beam us telemetry that is interesting to them, that is specific to their application. What we've gone and built is an architecture that is agnostic to where the data comes from, or in many cases, even what the data is. Our job is to be able to take in all kinds of telemetry about our customers' infrastructure, about what's happening on the internet right now, and provide our customers tools to make use of that telemetry in making smarter routing decisions.
So the customer can use the API to tell you that certain data center has overloaded WAN links, or that they're running out of servers in that mm-hmm. data center, or they can use the existing network monitoring software to integrate with you, and then that link is sort of done automatically, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
So which network monitoring solutions do you support?
A whole variety. Our favorite right now happens to be CatchPoint. It turns out that a lot of customers at the upper end of the space are making use of CatchPoint just because of the breadth of, first of all, coverage, and second of all, capabilities that the platform brings to bear. CatchPoint is a tool that we use internally as well to optimize our anycasting. And it's, I think, quickly becoming an industry standard. There are other tools that we think are pretty interesting. So another fairly shiny new company in the space is called Cloud Helix. These guys are doing network monitoring in very interesting ways. And we think it makes sense to have their data beamed into our platform and used to make routing decisions. And then, of course, there's your bread and butter monitoring providers. So guys like Pingdom, of course, or Amazon CloudWatch or Rackspace Cloud Monitoring, or many, many others. And, you know, very frequently we'll have a customer come to us and say, well, I'm actually using this other monitoring tool. Can I make use of it? And that's when we can go and do an integration. Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, you mentioned sort of geolocation mm-hmm. when you started describing what you can do. The problem I always had with geolocation is, as you said, the geographical location has nothing to do with performance or with how close things really are network-wise. And then there's this other nasty problem that you are actually looking at the location of the resolving DNS server, not at the actual mm-hmm. client. So how do you solve these two problems?
So I'm glad that you split those problems in two, because they really are two totally different problems. So let's take the latter first. And this is that when we get a DNS query, most of the time the IP address we are looking at is the IP address of the DNS resolver and not of the end user. And indeed, in some cases, user is using a DNS resolver that is somewhere other than where they are, right? So There's a couple of solutions to this. The first, which is interesting but maybe less interesting, is an extension to the DNS protocol that was proposed now maybe 3 or 4 years ago by a group of CDNs and recursive DNS providers, including Google and OpenDNS. So users of Google and OpenDNS are maybe most subject to this kind of a constraint, because those resolvers are anycasted, and they may indeed not be physically located anywhere near where their real users are. So what was proposed is an extension called EDNS Client Subnet, and what that does is causes resolvers that support it to forward information about the actual end user's IP address to the authoritative DNS provider. So in particular, Google and OpenDNS will forward the first three octets of a V4 address of a requester to us. We're the only authoritative DNS provider that I'm aware of that actually supports EDNS client subnet. And this is why we have a lot of CDN customers and others that care about this kind of thing. For Google and OpenDNS, we can provide much more accurate geographic routing or other kinds of routing that is based on the IP address of the user. So that's one nice thing. Another nice thing that we can do is be smart about improving our GeoIP database. And so we have some data collection and tools that we use to automate improvement of the GeoIP data that we have about other resolvers that are not sending us EDNS client subnet data. And in particular, to relate the geography of those resolvers to the geography of their end users. Because we really don't care if a resolver is in Dallas, Texas, if all of its users are in Houston. And so our job is to sort of suss out where are the actual users of this resolver, and to use that information as opposed to sort of straight up traditional GeoIP data to make those kinds of routing decisions. Now, there's one other point that you made, which is that geography indeed has very little to do with performance on the internet beyond a certain point. And so this is where we start to depart from geographic routing as the right way to do things. Our position and a lot of our technology is around the idea that if you're trying to optimize response times, or if you're trying to optimize throughput or minimize packet loss or something like that, you really ought to measure the metrics that you're trying to optimize and then do routing based on those metrics. So one of the things that we do is provide tools or APIs for gathering or beaming to us data about eyeball telemetry. So this is metrics like response times from the vantage point of end users with respect to our customers' different data center endpoints, and then turning that into routable data. By doing this, we bypass geographic routing or GeoIP altogether. You can imagine that if we get a DNS query from a user on Verizon in New York, we want to be able to answer the question, which of our customers' data centers is best servicing users on Verizon in New York right now? And that's a really nuanced question, mainly because of the word best, right? So the notion of best service depends entirely on your application and what it is you're trying to optimize. If you are an ad tech company, you probably care about, you know, latency or raw response times or time to first byte or something like that. And you're trying to make routing decisions that will minimize those response times. But if you're maybe a streaming media company, for example, you probably don't care at all if it takes 300 or 400 milliseconds to return the first byte of the MP3 file, but you really care that the buffering icon doesn't come up right when you're listening to the music. So, this is the other piece of the puzzle for us, is providing, first of all, tools for getting data into our platform that relates to these metrics, and second of all, tools for doing routing with that data.
Okay, now I get the concept. Mm-hmm. And I'm positive that some of your customers know exactly how to tie everything together. Hmm. But if I'm a newbie, how would I start collecting that telemetry that I could then send to you so that you could change your routing decisions?
Certainly. So, of course, the answer is it depends, right? And it depends on what your application is and then the kind of routing you're trying to do. And those sorts of things. But we certainly do provide some basic tools built into the platform for doing this stuff for customers who have never done it before. So, one is that we do have a pretty decent monitoring platform baked into our service offering. You know, you can think of it as sort of an amalgamation of what we found worked best among, you know, sort of mass market monitoring tools like Pingdom or Rackspace Cloud Monitoring or others. So many, many of our customers are using monitoring tools to do outside-in monitoring of their platform. The other piece of the puzzle is how do we get eyeball telemetry that is interesting and useful,
exactly.
Right? So the simplest, fastest way for us to start gathering this kind of data is we'll provide a little JavaScript blob to our customers that they can embed in their website or in their content. And that JavaScript blob behind the scenes starts to gather this kind of telemetry specifically for their endpoints and their end users. So that's the quickest way to get started. And then our more advanced customers, we actually provide them APIs to beam us data at high frequency, straight out of their applications. And so we often will even see customers doing things like integrating our APIs into their iPhone or Android apps to beam us data from mobile devices or other things like that. So, you know, there's a whole host of ways to start to get data into the platform. And then the next piece of the puzzle, the next hard problem, especially for somebody that's new to this stuff, is how do I actually make use of that data to make good routing decisions? And this is, you know, another piece of the puzzle that no one's really thought that effectively about in the past. And we've tried to rethink a little bit about how you configure routing in a DNS platform. And, you know, our name for our secret sauce here is what we call the filter chain. But fundamentally, simple idea is that it's a rules engine-like approach for configuring routing in a DNS record. So, you know, if you have whatever.com and an A record that you're trying to resolve and you've got 10 different data centers you could select from, and maybe we have some telemetry about performance with respect to all of those different data centers that you've started beaming into our platform. Our job is to make it easy for you to compose the algorithm that decides which of those answers comes out from that DNS response. And the way we do this is by providing some building blocks, some simple rules that our customers can drag and drop effectively into place and piece together to compose a more complex approach. So maybe, for example, if you're building a simple CDN, you first would want to examine all the answers and throw out ones that are currently down according to your monitoring or our monitoring or any monitoring. And second, you might want to sort them by, for example, one of these metrics like response time with respect to the end user who's doing the request. And third, you might want to pick the fastest one or two to return. And so each of those steps in the process we think of as a rule or a filter that you can put in place and mix and match to compose an algorithm that makes sense for your application.
Sounds perfect.
Well, we're working on it. Let's put it that way.
Okay, if I just go back to that JavaScript approach you described. Mm-hmm. So you provide a JavaScript script that I can include in my web page, and mm-hmm. it would collect probably the browser performance data, send it over to you, and then you do your magic, and I get optimal routing toward my data centers for all clients, regardless of where the client is.
In general, and so, you know, let's back up just a little bit because, you know, of course, any sort of JavaScript-based approach depends on
JavaScript,
you know, the users
being enabled. Yeah.
Well, JavaScript being enabled or the users, having enough users with enough coverage of, you know, the different networks that are making use of your application or visiting your website or whatever it is to gather interesting data. And so, you know, one of the most critical pieces of the puzzle is that we can always recognize when we don't have enough data and fall back to maybe a less optimal approach, but, you know, geographic routing or something like that, right? So maybe the most fundamental piece of the puzzle for us is knowing, okay, we don't really have enough or recent enough data to make a good decision here. Let's use this alternative approach, which is maybe not ideal, but good enough. Second, you know, the JavaScript indeed loads on a page view. If you've got JavaScript enabled, asks us, what should I measure? And so, you know, part of our black box is deciding, okay, this user is on this particular network, maybe Verizon in New York, and we don't have enough data about users on Verizon in New York. with respect to this particular endpoint in Ashburn, Virginia. So let's go measure response time to Ashburn, Virginia in the context of this user's page view. Right. This is what the JavaScript really does. It's just this tiny little blob that asks for tasks to run and then goes and takes measurements and sends us that data. And as you can imagine, customers of ours, big web properties, for example, are sensitive to including JavaScript in their site. They've already got a million analytics blobs or ad pixels, things like that embedded. They worry about things like cookies or other sort of privacy concerns. And so we've had to really minimize this little JavaScript blob to be the bare minimum, be as uninvasive as possible, and just go gather a little bit of data that improves routing for the customer.
Oh, but if I got it correctly, the moment your JavaScript is in the browser, based on the information you already gathered, you might tell the browser to test some endpoints, even though the original web page and JavaScript were served from a totally different endpoint.
That is correct. Yeah. And so, our job is gather a sufficient sort of breadth and depth of data to do good routing. And it's useful to be able to task a browser maybe differently than how we actually routed that user, right? And say, it would be interesting, even though we routed this user to Ashburn, to know what their response time would have been to Dallas. So let's go measure that and have that data on hand for the next person on their network in case we want to make a different decision going forward.
Highly interesting. So you're sort of transforming browsers into on-demand monitoring agents if you need them.
You can think of it that way. And, there's a whole industry around this called real user monitoring, right? So it's typically thought of as more of a monitoring problem. And you'll see many, many companies in the monitoring space offering RUM solutions. But it's typically in the monitoring context, a little bit less about gathering data that is useful for acting upon directly, right? And so we're using RUM in a very tight automated loop to gather data that we turn into routable data and beam out to our edges all over the planet in effectively real time. And so very quickly, we can notice, for example, that users on Verizon in New York are no longer able to connect via NTT to your data center in Ashburn. So we should route those users elsewhere with that kind of granularity. And this is what you get from a RUM-based approach as opposed to maybe an inside-out approach where we're monitoring out from your data centers to your end users, or a simple geographic routing approach that just doesn't have access to this kind of dynamic information that is always changing in real time as the network shifts around.
And now let's move a little bit beyond DNS. Mm-hmm. So with your approach, obviously, if you figure out that Verizon users in New York are better served out of Dallas for whatever crazy reason, the next time a request comes in where you can identify that this thing actually belongs to a Verizon, well, comes from a Verizon user in New York, you reply with this other data center's IP address. Mm-hmm. This obviously relies on TTLs being pretty low, right?
That is correct. And so, this TTLs and caching are the biggest constraint in DNS, and they're not going anywhere, right? So there's a few things worth talking around with respect to caching and TTLs in DNS. So one is, indeed, we are seeing TTLs come lower and lower and lower among our customers. It's not uncommon to see 30 or 60 second TTLs. And the only issue that we continue to this day to run into with low TTLs like that is that there are some resolvers out there still, legacy resolvers, we'll call them, that ignore TTLs that are too low, according to whatever ancient whatever that means, right? So that said, that problem is slowly starting to dissipate. Of course, the flip side of that is that there's a lot more DNS traffic as you reduce your TTLs. The other piece of the puzzle that is actually very interesting, something that we've observed in practice for years, is that you can have a real impact on application performance way faster than the TTL of your DNS record. And so here's an example, case Y. Imagine your infrastructure in your data center, one of your data centers is saturated, right? You've sent too much traffic there and it is overloaded. You know, your CPUs are pegged or your transit port is used to capacity or something like that. The question is, can we relieve that pain and improve performance out of that data center for users who are stuck there because of TTL faster than the TTL of the DNS record? And the simple answer is yes. And the reason is that the moment we notice that, we can stop sending new traffic there, right? So any new user whose DNS resolver has expired its cache and is asking the authority for a new answer, we can stop sending traffic to that overloaded data center. And that turns out to have a very quick impact in terms of reducing load on the data center by stopping sending new users there. So TTL is a constraint, but maybe a misunderstood one in many cases. There are situations where we can act much faster than TTL.
And then there is the other thing called, I think, DNS spinning into browsers, right?
So that I'm not so familiar with.
The way it was explained to me was that due to whatever security problems that they continuously had with DNS spoofing, the browser would not honor the TTL. It would just get stuck to a certain IP address for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes.
So I would think of this as similar to the sort of legacy behavior that we see in some resolvers. And I'm honestly not very familiar with this idea of, you know, kind of ignoring TTLs in the browser. And, you know, our message in general to anybody who is a client of DNS is honor the TTLs because they're there for a reason. And in general, the application developer has chosen a TTL because they're trying to achieve a particular behavior.
I couldn't agree more, but you know that there are certain people out there that would religiously oppose this idea.
Of course. Everybody thinks they know better.
Of course.
Including us.
So with this TTL magic, you can, for example, easily move load away from one data center if, for whatever reason, I have to take it down, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, so that is a situation that is subject to TTL constraints, right? So the moment you disable a data center, right, in DNS, you stop responding with it, what you will see is a very long tail. And this is how we know which resolvers are paying attention to TTLs and which aren't, right? So if you say mark a data center down in our system and stop sending traffic there, and your TTL is 60 seconds, right? Something like 90-ish percent of the traffic will indeed go away in roughly 60 seconds. And then maybe 95% will go away after 5 to 10 minutes. And then there's this long tail of bajillions of, well, not bajillions, but a small percentage, 4 or 5% of resolvers that'll keep sending traffic there for, almost an indeterminate amount of time at this point. And you will see a long tail of users who are just sort of stuck there for a very long period of time. So DNS is always not always the best way to fail a data center, but it is a way to have great impact on, call it the load of a data center or the workload serviced by a data center very quickly.
So with DNS, as you said, I can influence between 90 and 95% of the traffic coming into the data center.
Quickly.
Yeah. And then if I really want to take it offline without impacting the residual 5% of the users, then I probably have to deploy routing tricks like start advertising that same IP address from a different data center, right?
Exactly this. And so, that, you know, if you look at how modern CDNs are built, it is exactly this combination, right? So we see sort of geographic or performance or metrics-based routing in the DNS, but then what I would usually call regional anycasting, right? So two or three different data centers, maybe all on the west coast of the U.S. or the east coast of the U.S. or in different geographic regions that anycast and announce the same IP space. And this is specifically for this reason, so that the data center can be very quickly failed, so that, you know, that last 4 or 5% of users is not subject to sort of outage or downtime because they're using resolvers that don't behave nicely.
So now we know how to move the load into a data center, how to get it out, how to shut down the data center. There's this one other interesting feature I've seen on your website called stickiness. I know what stickiness is in a load balancer, but what's stickiness in the DNS perspective?
So it's a little bit different, and the use cases are a little bit different. And it's, again, of course, subject to the constraints of the information that we have at DNS lookup time, right? So what I'm always very careful to say is that what we're not doing is session stickiness, because we have no notion of a session in DNS. But what we can do is consistently route the same requesting IP addresses to the same data centers, and we do this with some consistent hashing, right? And there's a very real use case for this, especially we see this with a lot of our ad tech companies who are trying to optimize cache locality, right? So simple use case that we sometimes see is an ad tech customer who, for example, has a big colocation deployment on the East Coast and the West Coast, and then maybe they also have a smaller deployment in AWS on the East Coast and the West Coast, and AWS is meant to act as a more elastic data center for absorbing large influxes of traffic. So, for example, a big ad buy happens, and suddenly traffic spikes 10x what it was before. What we will do is shift some traffic to the Amazon deployment and ramp it up elastically and then shift it back away as that traffic dies down. But nominally, 99% of the time, what we are doing is sending a very small chunk of traffic to the Amazon deployment to keep the application caches warm. And then data cache locality is also critically important. So we want to send the same users consistently to the Amazon deployment versus the colo deployment. So the real use case that we most frequently see for stickiness in DNS is exactly this. It's data cache locality and maximizing that. And it's okay if every now and then a user is routed to a different data center. We're doing our best to route most of the users most of the time to the same set of data centers based on, you know, their resolver IP or, as I mentioned earlier, eDNS client subnet data.
Oh, now that you mentioned the eDNS client subnet, does that work for IPv6?
That's a great question. And so I don't really know the answer. You know, IPv6, and here you may start to disagree with me, is something that we have, you know, avoided to a certain extent so far, because any casting with IPv6 is a very hard and, you know, less understood problem. And so we actually do not announce, we own IPv6 space, we don't announce our name servers on v6 space, because we are less able to sort of guarantee the performance that we require for our users. So we've quite honestly done a little bit less with v6. Now, that said, I am pretty sure that eDNS client subnet is v6 ready. I can tell you that we're not getting v6 eDNS client subnet data in our network today.
So your name servers are still on IPv4 only.
That is correct. And you'll find, I think, most of the major managed DNS players, that remains the case. And the simple reason is any casting IPv6 is very hard.
Yeah, and most people go through some recursive DNS server anyway. So even if they are on IPv6 only, the server would then resend the query over IPv4. So that's okay.
Sometimes, not always. And, you know, we definitely see cases where we would be interacting with a different, you know, a resolver network via v6 if we were running a v6 network. What we haven't seen is, you know, the evidence that trying to do the anycasting with v6 at this point would really pay off for our customers.
Mm-hmm. But what if a customer wants to offer their content over IPv6? Can you handle Quad A records? Can you do intelligent routing for v6 Quad A records?
Yes, most certainly we can, and we have plenty of customers who do that. And, you know, one of the basic sort of concepts in our platform is that the idea of intelligent routing should be decoupled from the kind of record that we're routing. So, you know, all of this fancy routing that we're doing, certainly we have customers doing it on A records and CNAME records and indeed Quad A records, but even on MX records, right, or TXT records, the same kind of routing techniques can be applied. I'm not sure why you'd want to do it on a TXT record, but you just never know. Could be interesting.
So from the application level perspective, you just treat all the records equally. You don't care whether it's V4 or V6. From the connectivity perspective, you're still only on V4.
That is correct.
I'm fine with that. As long as you support content, well, customer content over IPv6, I'm fine with that.
You know, there's one other interesting note, I suppose, about IPv6. And this is, we do run into this question on occasion for customers who are operating their own networks, right? So sometimes we have customers who are in the hosting industry, for example. And, you know, something I mentioned very early on that we sell beyond our SaaS-based managed DNS platform is private DNS networks. And so this is the idea that, you know, given servers in a pile connected to the internet, wherever they are, we don't really care where, right? We can push a button and spin up a new DNS network on those servers in a few minutes, thanks to automation. And so we sell this capability as what we call private DNS networks. And it means that we build and deploy networks in very unique topologies for customers with very specific requirements, sometimes even, you know, on-premise behind their firewall, all the way up to big global Anycast dedicated DNS networks. And on occasion, we do have customers come to us and say, hey, I'm all V6 and I want a private DNS network. Can you do it? And the answer is sure, yes, we can. It's simply for, you know, our big global managed DNS network that is Anycasted and you know, really very focused on high performance delivery, where we haven't seen the case for V6 yet.
Ah, so if I decide to go for private DNS, so I'm running my own DNS servers, those servers happily work over V6.
That is correct.
And as you said, with the private DNS, I just have to tell you where to deploy those servers and everything happens automatically. And it can be inside or outside of the firewall.
Indeed. Yeah. And so, you know, we see a few use cases for this on occasion that are most common. So the most common use case so far for us is internal DNS or service discovery. So we'll have, again, for example, maybe an ad tech customer who is using us for their big public-facing external DNS. They will like our APIs and our tools and our reporting and that kind of a thing. And they'll say, you know, we're running bind in the data center for our kind of production service discovery. Can we put your capabilities inside the data center? And this is what we use private DNS networks for. We'll deploy behind their firewall and, you know, they'll access DNS for their internal DNS, you know, over RFC 1918 space or something like that, purely behind the firewall. And then we do have customers in what I sometimes call the Amazon.com scenario. If you go look at what Amazon does for DNS, they use two providers, and that's for a very specific reason. They don't trust either provider, not to have a bad day or go down or lose connectivity or something like that, right? So they're hedging their bets by leveraging two major DNS providers. And there's a problem with that, a real problem, which is a orchestration and configuration problem. The moment you start using any of these advanced features of a DNS provider, so certainly things like health checks and failover and geographic routing, and then some of the more advanced stuff we've been talking about, those features are proprietary to the platform you're using. They are not, you know, baked into DNS. And so what you lose is the ability to do slaving or secondary DNS between two providers if you're taking advantage of these advanced features. So what you see is somebody like an Amazon or anybody else who's using multiple DNS providers but is also using these advanced capabilities always ends up writing some kind of a tool. It's always some sort of internal tool that some poor developer has to build and maintain internal to the company to orchestrate config changes across the two different providers. What we realized is that private DNS networks are a great way to solve this problem. So sometimes what we'll do is we'll deploy a customer onto our big global Anycasted managed DNS network, and they will say, well, I really want a secondary network for this dual network level of reliability. So we will go build them another Anycasted network that is physically and logically totally separate on the delivery side from our managed DNS network. So they get that level of reliability, but that it's the same platform, right? So the orchestration problem is solved. It turns out there are some nice cloud providers out there today in, you know, 20 plus data centers around the planet who have built networks that are amenable to Anycasting. And so it is entirely possible to spin up a global 20 node Anycasted DNS network in a few hours. And that is a real transformation from what was possible even 4 or 5 years ago.
Perfect. Now, if I want to learn more about your product and your company, where can I find more information?
That is a great question. Obviously, we have a website. It's nsone.net, nsone.net. Certainly lots of information there. Another great place to find us is at industry events. So, we're often trolling around places like Interop or Velocity or Surge, other conferences like that, sometimes speaking at those. We're friendly people. We like to chat. So come find us and we can talk some more. We're in New York. Often we are at meetups, things like that in New York, also in San Francisco. We're generally kind of out and about. So you can also just Google us, NSONE, and there's plenty of articles, things like that out there.
And if I decide that I want to test your platform, you have any trials or anything along those lines that I could use to figure out how things work?
Absolutely. Very uniquely in the space, we publish pricing.
Isn't it?
Our entire focus is to be friendly to engineers and developers. And so we want to make it easy for them to come and sign up and start tinkering and not be crippled, right? So we have a free tier, which is very generous and is entirely not feature locked. So every feature of the platform you can use for free. You can come sign up on our website and have an account and do up to 1 million DNS queries a month, which is enough for most small startups and other websites like that.
Oh, so 1 million DNS queries a month is free.
That is correct.
After that, you start charging me.
After that, we need the credit card.
Of course, that's fair. And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that? Do you have a blog? You have a Twitter handle?
Of course, yeah. So we have a blog on our website, and all the social stuff is linked there. But myself as well, feel free to tweet at me, BEEVEK on Twitter. It's my old college username. And, I'm always happy to chat.
Perfect. So thank you for being with me on the podcast today.
And thank you, Ivan.
I hope you'll be at Interop in Las Vegas, and then we can meet in real life.
Yeah, I hope so as well. And thanks a lot for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you. And for those of you who are not regular listeners of this podcast, I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and you can find me on ibspace.net, where you'll find links to my blogs, all the other articles and webinars I'm doing. And if you're interested in SDN, you really should go to sdn.ipspace.net, which is a page dedicated to all the SDN resources I put together in the last 4 or so years. So there you'll find articles, books, webinars, workshops, presentations, videos, everything you need to get started in the SDN space. Finally, if you like this podcast, you can go to podcast.ipspace.net and subscribe, so you'll get all the new episodes automatically. And last but definitely not least, go to iTunes and review the podcast, because we still don't have enough reviews. Thank you.